The AI thing is very real. In the same way, what I refer to as Web 1.0, you know, the 1995-ish era into streaming in the early 2000s, shifted the way we do everything we do in our lives. This is that.
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
Welcome back to the Brian D. O'Leary Show. Today we've got Dave Nugent with us. Dave's co-founder, CEO of Next League, technology advisory and solutions provider that exclusively services the sports industry. And he wrote a new book, The Business of Sports Technology, published by the Sports Business Journal on April 14th this year, 2026. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be here.
First question, not about the book. In your bio, okay. Says you're a fisherman.
I am.
So am I. And we've had a few guests on the show about fishing. What type of fishing do you like to do?
I live on the east end of Long Island, so surrounded by saltwater. So tidal stuff, mostly, not a lot offshore, but back bays and those kinds of things. I was out last night, in fact.
Striper
fishing right now.
Yeah.
We get it now and in the fall again. And if after that, unless you go out past Montauk or Block Island, you don't get a lot here. But
yeah,
fluke, striped bass, weak fish.
Great. Yeah. Well, something in common here. So this is good. So the book is Business of Sports Technology, and that can mean a lot of things. Today, 2026, as we get further and further into the year, AI is on top of mind for most folks. And, you know, this intrigued me. Your book intrigued me I think the pitch is about AI. It's way more than that. However, AI has a huge part in this cultural discussion. And you talk about AI hype versus the true ROI, return on investment. And I think a lot of the AI hype, I would argue, is the unknown.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll start by saying I started writing this book 2 years ago. The world was looked like a very different place 2 years ago than it does now. You know, this is one of the challenges to actually printing books these days, is at the pace at which the world moves. Now, that said, the book is more philosophical than it is about the tech itself. It's more about the way you think about deploying technology and the investments you make in technology, which is the reason it's called The Business of Sports Technology, not just technology. The AI thing is very real, right? It is, in the same way, I think, what I refer to as Web 1.0, you know, the 1995-ish era into streaming in the early 2000s, shifted the way we do everything we do in our lives, right? This is that. You know, I don't dive deeply into the deployment of artificial intelligence in the book, but it's reshaping the way sports organizations do what they do in real time. And it's an organizational shift. It's not just do you decide between Microsoft Copilot and ChatGPT? It is really shifting the way all of us do what we do.
Right. Yeah. And as I got into this book, I'm like, all these, you couch it in sports specific terms. But a lot of you could be in any business and read this book and like, okay, I get it. Why sports specific as opposed to business in general?
Well, sports is the world that I've lived in for 30 plus years. I tend to agree with you. You know, I debated that the competencies that I refer to in the book, which are, you know, the things that you need to consider as an organization in order to make smart technology decisions, are not really different for sports than they are for anything else. The one thing I would say is that the sports industry overall tends to trail a lot of other verticals. So, you know, retail and healthcare, for example, typically are ahead of where sports sits, retail especially. You know, anything that's direct to consumer, anything tends to lead from a tech standpoint. But those competencies, you know, the idea that you need good counsel, right? You need to have the right folks helping you make decisions. You have to make good choices. You need good governance inside your organization in terms of who should be in charge of what when it comes to the deployment of technology. And then you need to execute well. Those competencies are the same really in any industry. but the lens through which I see the world is sports, because that's the world I've lived in for so long.
Right. And I think you mentioned in the book somewhere, it's like the sports organizations, no matter really how big they are, they're small compared to what you're talking about in retail and all this stuff where, you know, you can be the trailing indicator.
Yeah. Look, if you think about the NFL as a great example, right? That is today, you know, approaching a $24, $25 billion business. It's not a big company by big company standards, right? That's not a Fortune 100 company where you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars or even trillions of dollars in the case of the big tech companies. So these are, and that's the really big one, right? A lot of sports organizations are significantly smaller than that. You know, most of them, some are even eight-figure annual revenue businesses. Most are nine.
Okay.
But, you know, they're, again, by big company standards, they're not big companies.
Sure. Yeah. We had a fella on the show recently, Nick Green, who was talking about soccer.
Yeah.
And he did mention the analytics within soccer. And he mentioned in his book and in the conversation about Messi, about the motion capture and tracking him and how they're learning a lot about that. And you mentioned in your book too. So I was like, oh man, all these things dovetail together. The advanced analytics in sports technology is one of these things that everybody is trying to chase. Baseball was doing it a long time ago, but like pencil and paper type things.
Yeah.
And soccer, there was no real way to measure it. Except now you have this motion tracking. Okay, this would never have happened without motion capture. You have anything to say as far as that goes? Optical tracking.
Yeah, optical is kind of the next, certainly on the sport performance side, optical tracking and the increases in the way that tech performs, the speed of which that technology performs is helping. You know, you think about a sports business, it's divided into two separate things. There's the business side of sports, which is media and the way fans experience the game and tickets and food and bev and merch and all that stuff. And then there's sports operations. So in soccer, operations or international football operations, they are leveraging technology.
It's a safe space here, Dave. We can call it soccer.
Depends. It depends on who you're talking to. You know, sometimes I'm talking to folks in Europe and they don't always refer to it as soccer, obviously. Yeah, that side of the business, the sports operations side of the business is leaning in heavily to technology because even incremental returns can help performance, but it also can be injury prevention and understanding how an elite level athlete like Lionel Messi performs. If you can duplicate even a piece of that, your family might make a lot of money, right? Like, so that is certainly a focus for a lot of folks.
Yeah. As far as, I guess, the tech here goes, the AI, the motion tracking, you have also really in the last 3 months, these agentic AIs have been making a lot of news and a lot of people are using them. And you mentioned in the book here, calling it like a scatterbrained employee to some degree.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's past that now. And, you know, if we have this conversation in 2 months, it'll be significantly past where we are now. The pace at which this technology is changing is incredible. The idea of agentic, you know, you're talking about technology that will manage itself and improve itself over time. So this is no longer, you know, traditional technology was a series of conditional statements, right? Conditional logic, like tell a machine, if this happens, then do this, right? We're past that. So this is technology that actually understands the environment it lives in, I'll air quote the word lives, it's not technically alive, but can adjust the way it performs and behaves in real time based on the conditions around it. That is, you know, for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s and saw, you know, Terminator and things like that, like, you know, we're not there, and we could get there, but at least at a business level, we are talking about, if not the replacement of humans, certainly the replacement of a lot of tasks that humans are used to performing,
right?
And possibly the replacement of humans for certain types of skills.
Yeah, and everything I've been hearing, and just my use of it, it's the speed at which things can be accomplished, and like you're saying. Yeah. It's like a lot of these tasks that, man, like going to research something and finding it and fooling around on the internet, or even, God forbid, going to the library, it's going to take me hours or days to do. And, you know, I can just get this piece of information in seconds. And that efficiency is huge. And you don't need people to necessarily do that. And I think that scares people when they say, oh, the jobs are disappearing. But it's like, why do I have to spend my valuable time hunting down this stuff and just fiddling around? My time's worth more. Everybody's time's worth more, particularly in the sports industry. Can we use these minds, people's minds, in much more efficient ways?
That's actually, in my view, a very healthy way to think about it, right? Like, this is not necessarily the replacement of folks. It's the replacement of the time that they spend and what they spend that time on, right? So you want highest and best use. If you run an organization of any size, you want your people focused on their highest and best use, not menial tasks that could, in theory, at least be done by a machine. For now, that is the way that this technology is being deployed. You know, the more human-to-human interaction side of this exists, the less machines are good at it, right? You know, you and I can look at each other and have a conversation and know, for now at least, that I'm talking to a person and you're talking to a person. And that level of trust is important.
Yeah.
That's changing, obviously, in real time.
AI podcasts and all that, yeah.
I actually, as a side note, anecdote, I met a guy at the NFL, at the Super Bowl, at the media row where they do all the media. And he's a guy from Australia who, he's been recording a podcast for a while. And he fed that podcast into a large language model. And then now he just gives his version of AI a transcript of what he wants to talk about. And it delivers it in his voice. And he can't even tell the difference.
Oh, wow.
So it is, we're entering a brave new world now.
That's scary to some degree, but I have heard people do that. And, like, you know, even the video is becoming different. I mean, I guess it's out of the scope here of the sports business of sports technology. However, you know, you mentioned, like, in a couple months, maybe a few weeks, we're having a different conversation here.
Yeah.
So toward the end of the book, you offer some predictions, but I think, very carefully, like, you can't just decide, like, oh, this is going to happen. Because I think you mentioned Jeff Bezos talking about change. And it's like, it's unknown. You know, we're trying to predict the future is unknown, but what's not going to change? I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, what are the permanent things? We talk about the permanent things a lot. Like, what is not going to change, and working around that? And then
I think even when Mr. Bezos, is obviously a very successful guy, made that statement, I don't even think he could have imagined what that meant. Look, I think we will continue to move towards more and more personalized experiences for us as fans. And when you think about the upcoming generation, you know, speaking specifically to the sports industry, what they expect and the way they behave, they don't necessarily can consume content long form the way that maybe folks that are my age did, right? They sit down and watch a full basketball game that takes, you know, 3 hours, or a golf event that starts on a Thursday and goes all the way through to Sunday. You know, it's not, you're going to lose some percentage of those folks. Now, they may consume more of that content, though, just in very, very different ways. Mm-hmm. And it may be a super personalized version of that content. It may be that they only care about Scottie Scheffler on the PGA Tour, and they only want to see, you know, the holes he birdied, and they only want to see him when it was raining, or, you know, whatever, under whatever conditions they're interested in. So it doesn't necessarily mean that less of these sports or the sports content gets consumed. It's just that it will be delivered and consumed in much different ways.
You know, they want you passive. They want you consuming their sanitized, corporate approved version of reality. But if you're listening to this, you already know the engineered decline is real. It's time to stop accepting it and start building independence. Join the Junto. It's our private counsel for the unapologetic American. Get exclusive strategic briefs, unvarnished cultural truths, and the playbook for enduring wealth. Click the link in the show notes or go to O'LearyReview.com and upgrade your subscription to Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review, today. Let's reverse the decline. You consult with the PGA Tour or golf in general, and And I found a number of years ago, the Masters app, which I don't know if you have anything to do with that, but the Masters app really answered a lot of those questions for people who wanted to use the app. Not everybody wants to watch the Masters on the app, but you can have every shot. And I think historically, they have most of the shots that have ever been filmed on television.
Yeah.
And you talk about the why. Like, why are these organizations using technology? And I thought reading through that the Masters really got it early.
Yeah.
They get a lot of things pretty early, but a lot of these other organizations didn't. And you talk about the NBA and Major League Baseball and compare those, where the NBA, during the early part of social media virality, they were allowing clips of Jordan, Dr. J, Magic, all these guys, historical clips. And Major League Baseball went out of their way to, you know, if you posted anything on social media, they'd shut you down. And yeah. I remember talking to one of my friends. He's like, this is like the dumbest thing. They're not going to grow. And you see the NBA, and then you mentioned this in your book. And it's like, well, the NBA, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they had a why either. Major League Baseball did have a why, because their tech was so invested, or they were so invested in the tech, and they didn't want it to go away. But when the NBA allowed it, it was like, oh, this is the way it's going. And Major League Baseball had to, you know, tuck their tail and run. And then,
well, look, these things are always, for clarity, I never made a reference to the Major League Baseball tucking their tail.
No, that's me. That's me. That's editorializing me.
Look, these are cultural decisions. In many cases, if not most cases, driven by media rights, which is where all the money is, right? Mm-hmm. So the reference you made, first to the Masters is a private club, mm-hmm. right? It's an event held by a private club, and they control the way that all of those things are done and consumed. You're still, even here in 2026, you're not allowed to have your phone on the course at Augusta. That is because it's up to them. Right. Mm-hmm. The way they deploy technology, primarily via their partnership with IBM, is the way they want to deploy technology. They put on an event that takes a little over a week, a year from setup to conclusion. And that's the way they want to do it. Culturally, the NBA and Major League Baseball, to your point, were in a very different place. Adam Silver believed in that moment back in the day, right, when social media first started to surface and clips were getting out, that a rising tide would rise all boats, and this is not cannibalistic. The pie is growing, right? We're not taking away. We're adding to. Major League Baseball had been out in front of tech for a very, very long time, and you know, not all of these organizations are set up culturally the same way. Eventually, everybody was like, "Hey, yeah, this is reach, right? This is just going to help us. This is going to bring in a different type of a fan than it did before." But when these paradigms shift, there's really no way of knowing, right? Like there's right. What will the, is there a financial impact here? Ultimately, commissioners of leagues answer to owners who are focused on the sports growth, right? And they're all set up very, very differently. And a lot of the decisions you see are the result of what those cultures look like.
And I think a historical parallel would be, you know, in the 50s, these teams in baseball, they had to sell tickets, and that was their main thing, ticket revenue. And they drove everything to get people to come to the stadium. And then TV comes around, and then they were like, no, we can't do TV because that's going to take people away from coming to the stadium. Well, they didn't realize how much bigger of a market television was and how much more money. I mean, now I can watch any baseball game I want at any time. I don't even have to watch it live now. And that's a huge, huge difference as far as now. You can argue whether talking about culture and everything, but the money and the economics have totally changed not only television, but now the tech surrounding what we used to call television.
That's right. And, you know, on both the media and ticket side for baseball specifically, they play 162 games a year. 81 of those games are home, right? So you're talking about in a stadium that's between 45 and 55,000 seats, let's say, about a lot of money across 81 games. It's still a really important source of revenue, but to your point, it's not as big as the media deals that they get, both at a national and a regional level. So for some sports, smaller sports, baseball puts on professional baseball, not just Major League Baseball, but the minors. They put on more games per year than all other sports combined. Mm-hmm. Because there are multiple levels of minor leagues and they're played literally all over the country. Where a media rights deal doesn't exist, those ticket sales are still, to this day, critically important.
Yeah.
It is like sort of the local entertainment for many small towns across the country is people go out to the ballpark still to this day. And it's still got that pastoral aspect to it because of that.
Yeah. And I live in Silicon Valley now, and we have the San Jose Giants, single A farm club of the San Francisco Giants. And they do all sorts of promotions to get people to their games because, you know, there's minor league baseball, you know, you can watch it on internet now, but really like nobody's tuning in for that. In a large scale, they're tuning in to go see, all right, my local team, or perhaps the Giants have got a guy that's good and I want to see that. So they're driving ticket sales, and then whatever happens at the game is a huge thing for them because it's a really small business, those minor league baseball teams.
Well, without question. And all, by the way, all sports organizations make money the same way, right? It's media rights if you have them. It's subscription products for some, right, where you can sign up and watch a minor league game maybe on TV when they're on, and maybe that's $5.99 a month or something like that. And then everything else is what happens in the building. It's ticket sales, it's food and bev, it's merch, and it's the same for every sport, right? These are the things that drive that revenue. So, some of these things will not change. I think the way we think about what those experiences should be, pro sports teams especially are spending a lot of time, so are colleges, by the way, a lot of time on what that in-venue experience is to continue to draw people towards what is still a critically important revenue driver for them.
Yeah. And along those lines, you talk about the bankruptcy of, and then the dissolution of a lot of these regional sports networks that for a good portion of time were driving a lot of this media rights stuff. And, you know, there's a whole host of problems there were access to certain cable companies and this, that, and the other. But this model right now is, I wouldn't say it's dead, but it's in flux for sure. And how does this huge money that was supposed to flow to these teams may or may not flow? What is the solution there? Do we have one?
Well, there's certainly not a solution for replacing the guaranteed income that came from those subscriber-based contracts, right? Those old economics assumed bundles of subscribers who are not subscribing to those cable channels anymore, right? Like that's just a behavioral change. And the technology changed that consumer behavior faster than the model could adapt to the change. And now the question, you know, a lot of folks that don't understand those economics might say, well, why don't I just go direct to consumer and charge them a monthly fee to replace that? And the reality is that the guaranteed revenue they were getting, the affiliate revenue they were getting from the cable company was significantly in excess of what an individual group of people would pay in market to watch those games, significantly in excess of it.
Right.
So they're going to have to figure out new models. By the way, they're going to have to do it in a world where baseball may be facing a salary cap, TBD, right? There could be a labor lockout because of some of that dynamic, but most other sports have a cap. So you're now talking about, you don't have to worry about the NFL. Their deals are all national and they don't have to worry about local media rights. But for hockey and the NBA and MLS on some level, although they have a variety of different kinds of deals, they have to worry about the cap's going to go up, right? In the NHL, for example, the cap will go up. The regional sports dollar won't be there. So you're going to have to replace that dollar. And there's going to be a crunch around how you generate a positive bottom line dollar for these organizations.
Yeah. You talk the Pareto principle a little bit here too.
Yeah.
It's like, so 80% of the revenue comes from 20% of the fans. And it's like, you know, this is one of these things that most of us true fans are funding the sport, and we're the fans, and maybe I'm not a true fan anymore as much. I don't watch as much anymore for a lot of reasons, and I think that some of these leagues, baseball probably the most familiar with, but they not only are trying to attract more customers outside of that 20% ribbon that gives them most of their, but they're also trying to attract them in general, they're changing rules around the sport just to bring more fans in. Granted, maybe that marginal benefit of each fan is helpful, but the games themselves have, to me, degraded a bit because they're trying to chase everyone. Chase even just like a random fan that wouldn't be interested in baseball or soccer or whatever.
Well, look, that's, you know, part of what you're pointing to is the dynamic of ownership has changed, right? Now you have the richest people in the world own professional sports teams. You have private equity entering the space. They're very focused on profit, right? The value of the asset they invested in is top of mind, but also, can we run a profitable business here? And they're going to seek to influence the way folks consume these sports in order to, A, drive additional consumers, fans into the sport, but also to find new assets and inventory that they can sell. If you're a purist, right, you're not going to like a lot of this, right?
Like, yeah. I get knocked with that label quite a bit, Dave.
Well, you know, you don't like bigger bases, right? Like, no. you don't like a pitch clock, right?
But no.
These are things that have shortened the game.
Yeah.
And the numbers say, again, as a purist, you probably don't care about this, but the numbers say that more fans are watching. The games are literally shorter. And if you want to bring in the next generation of fans, you know, 18 to 32 year olds ish, baseball's audience was getting older. As, by the way, that's true of every sport. Golf's audience is much older. NASCAR's audience is much older. How do you bring in that next generation of fans?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that about golf, because I've been a golf fan all my life, play golf, you know, not as much as I used to, but I really enjoy golf more as I get older. And when you read about the history of golf television, David Halberstam had a great analysis of this in The Breaks of the Game. So I grew up in Portland, Oregon. That was wrote about the Blazers, but the NBA used to be second fiddle to the Kemper Open. Yeah. The NBA Finals was on at like 10:30 in the morning local time, because so they could fit the Kemper Open in. And then the final game was tape delayed. You couldn't watch it until late at night. And it's like,
right.
Oh, well, the golf broadcasting is, well, who's in charge of the broadcast networks? It's guys that are our age and older,
right,
who really enjoy golf. Right. And it's like,
right.
This is where they're getting into. So, but nowadays, I think with all the new tech, the shot tracers, et cetera, and the personalities, Scott, you mentioned Scottie Scheffler earlier. Golf with Tiger gone, you know, I think the tech and some of these guys are really helping moving the sport forward. This is just my perspective, but I'm also aging.
Right. Well, look, in my opinion, no sport benefits from technology more than golf, right? Mm. You've got, on a Thursday or a Friday, you've got 140 to 150 players spread out across 18 holes, you know, 18 different playing surfaces effectively, or 200 plus acres, right? You can't broadcast all of that at the same time, right? It's not the same thing as looking at a football field or a basketball court or a hockey rink. So, you know, what golf has been able to do via massive investments in technology, what the PGA Tour has invested in ShotLink, which is the ability to optically trace where a ball is within centimeters, basically, mm-hmm. and produce data about every single shot. And now every shot is live. It's called Every Shot Live. Like, you can watch any shot on the PGA Tour via their media partners and their internal channels. Like, no sport has benefited more from tech than golf in that sense, right? And it's a global sport. You have athletes from all over the world who compete in it. So yes, golf is certainly benefiting. They've had their challenges over the past couple of years with an upstart in LIV and, you know, some bad press around
that.
And
they tried a lot of this tech.
Yeah.
But there, as you point out early in the book, why?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that their why was necessarily as good as the PGA's why, but
yeah,
just an argument for another day, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciate your time here, Dave. And I know you got things to do here, but appreciate your time. Once again, the book is Business of Sports Technology, How to Make Smart Decisions That Drive Your Organization Forward. That's Sports Business Journal Publishing. Came out on April 14th, 2026. Any last words, Dave?
No, Brian, I appreciate the time. And it's always the fun discussion when you talk to another sports fan, another purist. I'm a bit of a purist myself, although the train has left the station for folks like you and us. Yeah. So yeah, it was a fun chat.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, that wraps up today's conversation with Dave Nugent. There's one thing to take away from this episode, is that the ground is shifting rapidly beneath our feet. We're watching a philosophical shift in how these massive sports entities operate, from AI stripping away menial tasks to maximize human capital, to the total collapse of the regional sports network cable bundles. The business of sports is ruthlessly adapting. We're also seeing the very rules of our games being rewritten. Bigger bases, pitch clocks, and sanitized experiences. These are all engineered to chase a younger demographic, while leaving so-called purists and traditionalists, leaving us in the dust. They're managing the decline of our athletic traditions, just like they're managing the decline of our culture. But you don't have to just sit back and watch it happen. So if you're tired of the sanitized, corporate-approved version of America, it's time to take a stand. Upgrade to a paid subscription to Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review. And when you become a paid member, you gain entry into the Junto. It's our private council where we fiercely defend the permanent things, champion economic patriotism, and map out how to build true independence outside their rigged system. Click the link in the show notes to upgrade your subscription, or you can go right to O'LearyReview.com. Stop accepting the engineered decline and let's start fighting back. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.